In Delaney, and I'm interviewing Ossie Davis. The date is 1/12/72. Hello, Mr. Davis.
Hi, how are you? Okay, how should we begin?
Well, as we were discussing earlier, the purpose of the interview is so that we can get some material on black artists, on their opinions about the culture, about how they got started, any people that are now no longer with us that you might have a particular interest in, that you might want to talk about. Imagine a student just going into the library and just listening, possibly doing some research, possibly trying to get into the field himself, or just possibly interested in what, you know, these people are doing. And knowing no other way to get a hold of it, DeShawnberg has a good collection. We're trying to add to that, and possibly one of the other things that we might want to do would be to interchange, a cultural exchange around the country of black artists, theater.
Well, let's see. The person who might know, well, you've already talked to Lee Whipple, you say.
Yes.
Well, there's, I guess you could talk to Dick Campbell. Have you talked to him?
No, we haven't.
Well, Dick Campbell was the founder of the Rose McClendon Players. Rose McClendon was a great actress whom I never met, but she was quite well known, and so that Dick Campbell and his wife, Muriel Ron, established this community theater in Harlem called the Rose McClendon Players. Knew Rose McClendon, but he knew people like Frank Wilson and I forgot the names of the people he did. But you find out from Dick Campbell, there were writers who wrote plays, which we did. Dick Campbell is, you'll find him, and he'll be able to give you some information on some of the old times.
Is he in New York?
Yeah. Through Dick Campbell, I got to know Laura Bowman, who used to be with the old Lafayette Players. I got to know, I must be tired, I can't think. There's the guy who played Sam in Casablanca with, what was his name? Dooley Wilson. I got to know Dooley Wilson through Dick Campbell. Dooley Wilson is an old timer. I got to know Ethel Waters. I got to know.
Is she still alive?
Yeah, Ethel Waters is still alive. I got to know several people through Dick Campbell. So I think Dick Campbell would be a guy who could tell you. He knows, you know, more of the old timers.
Where would I make his initial contact, that initial contact for him?
Well, I think he's in the, possibly in the telephone directory.
Okay.
He lives on 23rd and 8th Avenue. And if you can't find it, call me and I'll give it to you. There, have you interviewed Pigmeat Markham?
No.
Yeah.
That's a very good question.
Pigmeat Markham is one of the, have you interviewed Ubi Blake?
No.
You know these names, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, have you interviewed Noble Sissel?
No, we haven't.
Yeah. Well, all of these are people who made contributions to music, to theater, a long time ago, but who's still around, who will be able to. The people I mentioned are people who though they're, you know, old now, still have memories of how things started. Have you talked to Lena Horne?
No, I've been trying to contact Lena Horne, but she's been in and out of town, and she was working very closely with the Brooklyn Museum,
mm-hmm.
and they were the only people that I knew that could possibly contact her.
Duke Ellington is back in town now. The wife of Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
I suppose these are people you would be talking to. Well, I got my start in show business through Dick Campbell. I was a student in Howard University. And I met there Dr. Alain Leroy Locke, who was the first black Rhodes Scholar. He was head of the philosophy department, but he was basically interested in the arts. And he knew personally the great sculptor Richmond Barthé. He's no longer in the country. He knew Langston Hughes. He knew Marian Anderson. He knew Paul Robeson. He knew most of the artists who came through Howard University. Dr. Locke knew directly and was to some degree responsible for something good that happened to them. At Howard University, I met Sterling A. Brown, who is one of our outstanding poets, who's still alive in Washington, D.C., who would be eminently worth talking to. But through Dr. Locke asked me what I wanted to be, and I told him I wanted to be a playwright. Well, he knew I had come from a very small town in Waycross, Georgia, called Waycross. And a town which had no theater, all I had been exposed to was a picture show. And so he wanted to know if I wanted to, you want to be a playwright? I said, yes. So he said, well, have you had any experience in the theater? I said, no. Have you ever been inside a theater? I said, no. Have you ever seen a play? I said, no. So he suggested that when I got through with my education, that I come to New York and get with the Rose McClendon Players. And I did, and that's where I met Dick Campbell. And I worked with Dick Campbell, getting training and getting experience. And after I went, I worked with Dick Campbell for 2 years. We went to the World's Fair, 1940. We did a play on Booker T. Washington at the World's Fair. During that time, I also did a play written by George Nordfoot, who is still on the scene, a man worth looking up. He's currently with Westinghouse. I think he might be in the directory also. I met such people as Fred O'Neill at that time and a few others. After in 1941, in December, after the Japanese struck at Pearl Harbor, my draft number was up. And I went into the Army in January of 1942. I went to Liberia, West Africa, in June of 42, and I stayed there till February of 1944. 1945, I'm sorry. I came back to the States in 1945 and stayed until October when the war was over and I was discharged. I went back to my home in Georgia. And while I was there, I got a wire from the same Dick Campbell. Dick Campbell at that time was head of Camp Shows Incorporated. In other words, he was in charge of the Army's show business section. His job was to get talent and send it all around to the various theaters of operation. But he was still close to show business, and he sent me a wire, and he said that there was a play being produced in New York called Jeb, and it was about a young veteran just coming back from, a young Southern veteran just coming back from the war, and the problems he faced when he came, tried to get back, get a job down in Louisiana. And he thought that since I was both an actor and a veteran, that I might get the part. So I came back to New York, and I read for the part, and I eventually got it. This was in 1946. Jeb went on, opened on Broadway in 1946 in February. And though it didn't last but 9 performances, I think it was, I was immediately hired to go into the cross-country tour of Anna Lucasta.
What was the reasoning for Jeb's short run?
Well,
was it because of attendance or because of a fun background? Or
It's very difficult to ascribe any one reason to a show's success, even in 1946. It may be that the white audience wasn't prepared to, wasn't looking at black people on Broadway stage. That was a part of it. It may be that Jeb wasn't a very good play. You know, a thousand things might have happened. I say that because Anna Lucasta, which was also a black play, you know, had been running since 1944, and it was 2 years on Broadway. So it wasn't, you know, wasn't that blacks were excluded on Broadway altogether. But it may be because it was a serious play that there was no audience for it. But it only lasted those 9 performances. In it, I met William Marshall, who is still a great performer. I met P.J. Sidney, who is still a performer you might talk to. I met Laura Bowman, as I said before. I met Chick McKenna, who was an old-time player, but he's dead now. I met Dorothy Paul, who, I don't know what she was. She was an actor a long time ago. She subsequently died. I met Percy Verwaine, who was an actor, who's dead now. And my sister in that was a little lady called Rary Grist, who is now one of our outstanding coloratura sopranos in the country, as a matter of fact. She's one of our great operatic singers. She was in the cast of that particular play. I also met Ruby Dee for the first time in Jeb. After Jeb closed, we were hired, Ruby Dee and I, as I said before, for the cross-country tour of Anna Lucasta. But before we went cross-country, I played it in New York at the Mansfield Theater on 47th Street. And then I went to Chicago and played it there for about 3 months, from May through the summer, at which time I met and worked with Hilda Sims, who's still in New York. I met Earl Hyman at that time. I met John Bowie, who is dead now. John Tate, beautiful black man, beautiful black actor, who is dead now. Died of a broken heart, really, because there's no place for show in show business for a beautiful black gentle man. Then we came back and we got ready to go on the road. Also in New York, I met Frank Silvera for the first time in Anna Lucasta. On the road, we had such people as Lawrence Kreiner, who used to be one of the Lafayette players. And we also hired for the mother part Laura Bowman, so I met her again. I met Frank Wilson. Frank Wilson used to write plays. He was in the theater for a long time. He died in 1956. He was himself was about 60, but he was one of the old-timers, too. I met Monty Hawley. Monty Hawley was one of the comedians who used to be almost on the staff at the Apollo Theater. Monty and Lawrence Kreiner would work with some of the comedians like Pigmeat Markham or like Johnny Spider Bruce, we used to call him. I forget what his real name was. And they were in black show business. There was a circuit called TOBA, which the people called Tough on Black Actors. I forget what the thing meant now, but there was a circuit, including the Apollo. There was the Apollo Theater here, there was a theater in Boston, there was a theater in Philadelphia, a theater in Washington, D.C., the Howard in Washington, D.C., a theater in Chicago, I guess the Regal, I don't know. But there was a circuit, a vaudeville circuit, that black players, black actors, black units used to go around and perform for and with. Out of this circuit had come people like Lawrence Kreiner and Monty Hawley. While working with Anna Lucasta, I played also with Ruby Hill, was in Anna Lucasta, Janice Kingslow from Chicago, Yvonne Machen from Chicago, several other. I worked with 8 Annas altogether. all beautiful ladies. We started in September of 1946, somewhere in Connecticut, and we played week stops and one-night stands and split weeks all the way across the country. We stopped in such places as Detroit and Cleveland and Cincinnati and Toledo, Wichita, Kansas, St. Louis, Missouri? No, Kansas City, Missouri. We played in Colorado. We opened in Los Angeles and Analocasta in May of 1947. We stayed on the West Coast through June of 47, playing in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and then in Portland, Oregon. And then we went on up to Seattle, and the company was dissolved in Seattle.
In your travelings across the country with Analocasta, did you really come across any major problems in terms of housing facilities and acceptance by a particular community of your group coming in to put on this particular kind of play?
No, there were no problems. There were black people everywhere we went. Mm-hmm. And the situation was, I mean, we lived in a segregated society. And we had neither the desire nor it wasn't within our desire to live downtown in the expensive hotels. Mm-hmm. And in Chicago, there was a fantastic, a beautiful black hotel called the Evans. And man, you know, living there was like being home. I wouldn't want to go to the other places. In Detroit, we lived in a small hotel called the Mark Twain. It was a black hotel, but you know, it was fun, and we were home. We were always with our people. And even when we went to Wyoming or to Milwaukee, there was always a black colony somewhere. And we went basically to that particular place. We met the usual discrimination, I'm sure, but since we traveled in a group and we were only at a place for a night or two nights or maybe a week, the discrimination we met was seldom so blatant as to be a disturbing factor. I do remember one time at Fresno, California, there was some kind of altercation with one of our actors in a park, but that was quickly, we played that night and got the hell out of town, mm-hmm. So it didn't disturb us. You know, we were there, we were in the community, and...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Just let me know when you're ready to start, okay?
At Fresno, there was some kind of altercation, I remember, but it was a minor one. We were, you know, we were welcomed. Few black plays, in many places none had come before us. Mm-hmm. And some of the places we went, we met some of the old-time players who had retired and lived in the Midwest. When we went to Pittsburgh, for instance, Lena Horne's father was one of the big wheels there, you know, and we were almost his guests as we stayed in the town. And so on the whole, it was a very pleasant experience. And we worked, we saved our money, and we enjoyed being with each other.
Aren't you into producing now?
No.
You aren't into producing. Would you like to get into producing?
No.
You wouldn't?
No.
Directly?
Black folks get into producing and all wearing all kind of hats because we have to. I produce only when necessary. What I'm interested in is writing and directing and acting. Mm-hmm. Producing is a whole nother factor. You know, got to go out and beg somebody for money and do all the, you know, the problem with keeping your play alive, like Mel Van Peebles is having problems with things, supposed to die a natural death. But he's got to function as a producer. So you got to do everything to keep it going. That's enough, you know, it's too much of a headache. Mm-hmm. But writing and acting and directing are the things that I'm particularly involved in. We were always supported by, as I said before, the black community, both uptown. And when we had the small theater, the Rosenclendon Players, we didn't have grants. Grants were not given to black folks. We sold subscriptions, and that's how we lived. That's how we put on our plays. Four plays every season were put on. Mm-hmm. And we had people in the community who bought subscriptions for those four plays. And out of the money we made from with that, we put on our shows.
When you say prescription, do you mean you'd approach the black businessmen in the community or just the people living
anybody,
in the
community? Anybody, business people, preachers, whatever. Teachers, housewives, anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, you could buy a subscription, I guess it maybe $5 or $10 for the four plays. And anybody who would buy one, you know, we would approach it. We didn't have the problem of rent because we worked in the basement of the 124th Street Library, and we put on our plays there, and all we had to do was to go out and buy a few pieces of cloth and get enough lumber to build our sets, and, you know, hustle and make a little lemonade and sell it. So, you know, we managed.
Right.
It was, of course, in the Depression. Father Devine had his heavens going in Harlem, and we could go and live and get a full meal for 15 cents. So the economic hassle was not nearly as severe then as it is now. So we actors really made it. We could make it in our own community. There was a real live community theater in Harlem that catered to the needs of the community.
Right. Because of your success and because of the few successes that we can claim as a people, basically, we tend to exhaust the people in terms of always wanting to see them, always wanting to hear them, and in fact delegating them as our leaders when they in fact may or may not want that responsibility.
Right.
That, you know, to me presents a problem to the individual. How do you feel about that? And is it right for us, for instance, me wanting to interview you? Would we exhaust you at some point?
Well, the way the game is played in American society with black entertainers and black celebrities, quote, it would. We are in an awkward position, we black people. They only let a few of us, one or two of us, through at a time. And when that one person comes through, then he becomes, whether he wills or not, a representative of his people. And he will also be consulted by the media, by the white people, as to what the black folks think, because he's the one out there. So they will, you know, you become a spokesman whether you want to or not. Some of us, you know, we just drift into it. Somebody like Jackie Robinson, for instance, just almost automatically gets pushed into responsibilities in relationship to civil rights and whatnot. And even if you don't become a spokesman, you become, say, like Aretha Franklin, who gives benefits for, last time I was with her, we were doing something for Attica up at the Apollo. And then before that, she was doing it for Jesse Jackson out in Operation Breadbasket. And she does things like this in their performers. They don't take any political stance. They don't make statements and you know, explain black folks to white folks or black folks to black folks, but they do give up their time. Lena Horne is another person like this. It would be better if we were like everybody else. You know, if we had enough actors who were getting through and enough producers, enough directors, so that we didn't have to depend on the few who do come to carry the whole burden. But the consequences, it's one of the consequences of our powerlessness as a people. We can't afford. We can't afford to make stars. We don't own theaters. We can't afford to make motion pictures. We don't own distribution or we don't own studios. We can't afford. We don't own football teams. We don't own the things, or concert halls. We don't own the things which give blacks opportunities to become independent stars. So we have to let them go through the white institutions and then try and get the service we need from our artists from them, in spite of the fact that we can't support them. Mm-hmm. It's not their fault. It's not the black folks. People's fault. Basically, it's the fault of racism in our society. But I personally find it a problem because I don't consider myself qualified to speak in many areas, yet I'm called on to speak. And sometimes I have to speak because I'm the only one there and I have to say something. It means not only trying to keep up as an artist, not only I'm far behind, not only trying to keep up what's happening in the theater and motion pictures, but to be involved intimately in civil rights and all the other things, so that if you're called on to make a statement, you can make it articulately. A man like Dick Gregory, for instance, who starts out as a comedian and gradually becomes a spokesman, and last election was out there running for president. It's, you know, there's no other way we can do it. Now, Dick is called on also like Aretha Franklin. Whenever there's a problem and they need funds and need somebody, get Dick Gregory. And if he can make it, he'll be there. Now, he keeps running, and he'll have to keep running until he tires himself out. In Philadelphia right now, Paul Robeson is living in retirement in ill health. And one of the things that exhausted Paul was that he was so needed and so giving, and there were so many things he had to do, and, you know, fighting the white man, fighting the blacklist, fighting the State Department trying to get a passport, fighting for the right to sing, then singing, fighting political battles, running and helping. Mark Antonio was running for mayor. Paul was out there trying to get him elected. Wallace was running for president. Paul was out there trying to get him elected. Du Bois is running for Senate. Paul's out there trying to get him elected. So when Paul left here, after 8 years, I think it was, and went to Europe after he got his passport and worked, in a very short while, Paul collapsed. You know, he did a play, did a few concerts, then he collapsed. And he was ill, I think deathly ill, for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. He came back. He was still ill, but he began to get his health back. And then, unfortunately, his wife died. And he also had something was wrong. He had an inner ear disease, which makes him lose his balance. So he fell in a park, Edgecombe Park. He fell, you know, almost two stories down. He lay in the park all night. Nobody knew he was there. And he... So they found him the next day and brought him home. But since that time, he's been ill, tired, exhausted, really. And that is one of the problems. But it's nothing. There's nothing you can do about it, nothing I can do about it. It, you know, we find ourselves at this stage in history, and, you know, this is what we have to do. As I was saying to you before, you know, I've talked so much that sometimes I find myself not listening to what I say, which is not good, and I wish it were so. That there were more of us making the statements, more of us carrying the ball, that we sort of split the whole leadership thing up. But, you know, that will happen some of these days. But until it does, whoever is there in the position has to do it. So, I mean, I don't mind it. I try and maintain some sense of modesty and some sense of proportion. I try and remind myself, say, look, man, you don't know it all. You haven't had time to study economics. You haven't had time to study history. You haven't had time to study politics. You haven't had time to go around up and down the country to be able to fully articulate the needs of the sharecroppers, of the people on welfare, of the Black Panthers, or of the Masons, of the Baptists. You know, you ain't everybody. You can't speak for everybody. You know, I have to damp myself down sometimes to remind myself that, okay, all right, say something, but let the people know that it's your private opinion, you know, because you are not an expert in this field. You haven't had time to become one. Still in all, you have to do the best you can. I would like, for instance, to have functioned as a playwright. Still, I've written only one play, Pretty Victorious. I've written, co-authored one movie, Cotton Comes to Harlem, and a few other things. So my profoundest disappointment, and believe me, it is a very deep one, is that I'm not permitted to function in this society as an artist. But think of the people who are as talented as I am, or even more talented, or even more gifted, who don't even have, or haven't even had, the opportunities that I had. I, in spite of the fact that I'm crippled by all the other things I've got to do, I'm still a very fortunate man. I know people, friends of mine, who have given up or who have quit, who are alcoholics, who are dope addicts, because there's nothing for them. I mentioned a guy before, his name was John Tate. He was tall, and he was black, and he had beautiful skin, and a laugh, and a smile, and a very, you know, a lovely kind of person. And he could act out of this world. Beautiful man. After we came off the road in 1947 with Anna Lancaster, John Tate probably did one or two things. You know, he stayed around home. He was a nice guy. I drank a little. Finally, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, John Tate is up and died. And it broke my heart. This is a beautiful human being. Lovely man. Talented. Take a woman like Hilda Sims, whom I know and love. Hilda Sims was a star. Star here. She was a star in Chicago. Went to Europe as a star. Came back. Nothing has happened to her. You know, I never see Hilda on stage. What the hell, I mean, what the hell kind of, you know, kind of society we're living in when black folks in particular who have the talent, who have the know-how, who have the gift, are that completely excluded. And the system is so tricky that you keep showing the public, the ones who have made it, you keep showing an Ossie Davis, a Ruby Dee, a Sammy Davis, a Bill Cosby, and a Diane Carroll, and people like that, and the public begins to get the feeling, man, the black folks out there waiting. Show business is full of black folks. And you see in baseball, quite a few blacks. You see in football, blacks. You said, man, wow. Black folks are really moving in and taking care of business. And it is not so. Those few of us who are there represent so many thousands who are talented as we are, or even more, who, for whatever reason, don't even get the opportunity. The one thing that I'm most serious about in show business now is how to help the young people coming along both prepare themselves for opportunities, but more important, how to create the opportunities which they need once they are prepared. The one thing that I'm most serious about in show business now is how to help the young people coming along both prepare themselves for opportunities, but more important, how to create the opportunities which they need once they are prepared. I'm chairman of the Full Opportunity Committee, working out of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. What we hope to do originally was to set up a school and train people in every aspect of the communications industry. How to, you know, put on a television show, how to be a soundman, how to operate all the technical gadgets, directors, grips and whatnot. People who are behind the scene, who control the thing. You know, everybody knows that we are performers, you know, and we can dance and sing and act. That's marvelous, beautiful. We are out there and fine, but what about behind the scenes? What about the cameraman? What about the guy who's making policy? What about the guy who's making decisions, the writers and all that? That's where it's at. I'm also president of Third World Cinema, and we have a training program there where we're trying to train young blacks and Puerto Ricans in how to make motion pictures, in every aspect of making motion pictures. I mean, we can act, sure, in front of the camera, but what about behind the cameras? You know, electricians, grips, soundmen, costumers, makeup people, scenic designers, all of these things, there are thousands of people in them, white people, and they make thousands of dollars.
Are we as a people generally aware of this?
No.
Your applicant list, I mean.
Oh, yes. And the applicant list, you will find, I mean, we got more people than we could find jobs for, even if the industry was wide open and fat and healthy, which it isn't. Right now, we're in a depression. But there are thousands of young, qualified people out there trying to do it. And my job, and I think all of our jobs, who have attained some degree of prominence, is to reach back and help those behind us to come along. And because I couldn't have gotten where I was if Dr. Alain Locke hadn't taken the time to give me advice. And if Dick Cameron and Muir Ron hadn't taken the time to give me advice and feed me, give me a place to stay, or if people like Monty Hall, who I mentioned, didn't pull my coattail and say, hey, man, when you're on a scene like that, you don't have to move your mouth like, you don't have to do all that chewing. You just stand up straight and do it, you know, and be pleasant and, you know, and be on time. The discipline of the theater, they taught this to me. They took that time to tell me what it was about, you know. That's I grew up out of that. A lot of our performers grew up out of that. And so I feel that if they were kind enough to do that for me, you know, then I owe it to them, to me, and to the young generation to do the same thing. I'm not doing anybody any favor. That's my duty. It's my responsibility. If you love the theater and you want to see it survive, you got to do something. You know, you don't just sit there and rake in the gravy. A guy like Melvin Van Peebles, who goes out, raises his own money, shoots his own film, and almost has to distribute it himself, owns his own film, No black man has owned a film of his own and bring it in and it makes up in the $4, $5, $6 million. Now, there have been black filmmakers way back in the 1900s, Michaud and several others, made full-length features, you know, wrote them, got black folks in them, starred in them, and those films are still around somewhere. But they didn't make a great deal of money. They didn't make money at all. Melvin Van Peebles beat the cat at his own game in this day and age. Now, that is a young man whose story should be told to all young black filmmakers so they can say, if Melvin did it, I can do it. You see, it's all right for me. It's one thing for me to make it as a director. I directed Cotton Comes to Harlem. But Cotton Comes to Harlem is owned by United Artists. It has grossed up to between $5 and $6 million. Okay, most of that money came from black people in black communities, which means that Cotton Comes to Harlem sucked money from the black community, sent it to Hollywood, and it doesn't come back. Now, that isn't true with Melvin. The money that came out of the ghetto or wherever went to Melvin. He's a black man, so he's putting it... Right. So that's why I say Melvin is a much more important man in film than I am, because Melvin is doing more that relates to the needs of black people at this moment than I am. Now, I'm trying to help. I got training programs, and that's important. And I work in the Hollywood scheme of things, but I'm trying to break out of that and establish, or help establish, what we call a third world cinema. Third world cinema is composed of people like myself, Diana Sands, Brock Peters, Jim Earl Jones, Rita Moreno, Peter Thomas, who is a Puerto Rican author, John O'Killens, who is a black author. And what we propose to do is black material aimed at a black market and a black audience, and which will enable us to control our own product. Mm-hmm. We can, we'll see that it's distributed, but the money that the films make will come back to us, then we will make more films for black folks. There will not be the films, as I said before, like Shaft and Cotton Comes to Harlem, which makes oodles of money, which leaves our community and never comes back. There will be films like Sweetback, where the money is black in the first place and it goes and turns around and comes right back to the black community. That's what Third World Cinema is all about. Third World Cinema is trying to catch up with Brother Melvin. That's what we're trying to do. I've got to do this recording now. Maybe sometimes, if this isn't sufficient, maybe you can call me again and we'll do some more talking, okay?
I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you, and I'm sorry to have been such a pest.
You haven't.
But I run around sometimes.
A second interview with Ossie Davis, taken from Channel 13, is on side 2 of this tape.